Hey,
welcome
to the River Talk podcast, hosted by Zach Collier, Priscilla Macy, and after months and months of absence, me, Eric Whiteseth, back again, doing it one more time. This time, we're even recording video, so maybe that'll be a thing in the future. You just never know. You might get to see us and hear us. What a gift. This week, our big topic is PFDs and catching up after a long absence, probably. But as usual, we like to start with news of the week or something along those lines. So, Zach, Priscilla, what do you got?
Well, today's election day, so go vote if you haven't already. And vote for things that help protect rivers, things and people that help protect rivers and recreation. And that's all I say about that. The other news of the week, we talked about this a little bit on one of our podcasts. All through the West, there's been fires that have affected a lot of waterways that a lot of us enjoy to paddle. And in Oregon, and in other states, AW is trying to figure out a way to convey information about new obstructions and changing conditions of rivers. And in Oregon, we've launched will be launching soon, a mapping project that we're doing with the Marine Board to map all of that on an interactive map so that when folks start boating, they'll have a better idea of some of the new hazards and access issues that are on the streams that are still accessible.
So, will that be something where people just email somebody and they're like, let's say you find a new tree, mm-hmm. and then you email you, Priscilla, for example, and then you go into a database and update it so that people can check real time sort of what's happening?
Yeah. So what's cool, the ultimate plan is we have already developed an app, the Marine Board has. We're working on refining it right now. So basically what you could do is bring your phone with you on the river, which a lot of people already do. And you have this app already downloaded and it's called Quick Capture. And so you just take a picture with your phone, or if you don't have the ability to do that, you just basically, it geolocates where you are and you say what the hazard is, where it is, what AW stretch it's located on, and press okay. And that's it.
Wow.
And then on the back end, the Marine Board can adjust some of the information and add photos later. And so AW and the Marine Board will be kind of working together to make sure all that information is accurate and up to date.
And this is because there's a worry there's going to be a lot of strainers in the river. Like there's pretty apparently a ton of trees going to fall in. And that's a particular threat that we want to address.
Yeah. And even more so than strainers, there's going to be debris coming down the rivers from structures that have burned, landslides that'll be happening from high water and rain events. So it's basically just cataloging everything, not just woody debris, but that will most likely be the most common thing that's cataloged. And what's cool about it is the intent is that this will help inform not only the public, but also land managers, law enforcement, search and rescue, so that the choice isn't just close these areas. It's evaluate the areas, see what the actual condition is, work with the community, the users and the managers to allow reasonable recreation opportunities, but also protecting public safety. So it's a pretty good balanced approach in a time where there's a lot of uncertainty about these areas.
And you have to have the app?
You don't have to have the app. You can just email it into the Marine Board or to AW. If you wanted to, but the app is just super easy to use and you don't need internet to use it. It's all offline. And then it updates once you're back in internet range. So
this isn't done yet, you're saying, but it's going to happen soon. Mm-hmm. And what people can do is either download this app. What was the app called again?
Right now it's just on a format called Survey123, which is a GIS platform, but we'll have more details and we'll make an announcement through AW and through the OSMB. Along with probably like a tutorial video for people to learn how to use it and that sort of thing.
So paddlers can download this app when they're out paddling, see something, tag it, it gets sent automatically, they're done. Or when they're out there, take a photo or just remember sort of where it is and then email somebody and say, hey, here's a hazard. And hopefully somebody in AW or the Marine Board has time to enter more information about that obstruction.
Yeah. And the Marine Board has dedicated staff for this project. So there certainly wouldn't be a lack of capacity on their end, but it should be really a pretty simple process and just gathering information. So
that's cool.
More on that later, and we'll have a post with AW once we're ready to share it with the public.
I mean, it almost makes sense to be bigger. You know, you guys are doing it now because there's a lot, gonna be a lot of hazards. It would make sense to just have this for the whole country.
And yeah, and that's the goal. And we're already talking about it for other Western states and how to implement it. Obviously, when you don't have an agency kind of taking the administrative lead on doing a program that has cost, it's a little more difficult. So we're lucky to be in a state where they want to do this. But this could be a good example for other states to do similar programs. Hmm. So yeah,
oh, cool. That's
pretty much my news of the week. Zach.
I got just things to talk about that I guess it's news. One, I've spent the past 3 weeks working on an online rafting class at whitewatereducation.com. Just want to self-promote that. It's been a massive project. I'll put a link in the thing. It's basically like right now it's like 30 videos about how to row. It's been kind of fun. That and then Priscilla, we talked in a couple episodes back about talking to the sheriff about having a local search and rescue team. Mm-hmm. And I haven't called the sheriff yet, but I've been thinking about this a lot. You know, the idea is that each community has a group of boaters that can respond to some sort of swift water rescue incident if the sheriff finds out about it, right? Mm-hmm. And the one thing I wondered is this something that – I just want to get your thoughts. I've been thinking about this a ton. Is this something paddlers could just do, or would paddlers need formal training, or should they have formal training before approaching the sheriff's office?
Yeah, they would need formal training. And I think I touched on this a little bit, but maybe not. I'll just do another overview. So what would happen, because I've already had discussions with the OSSA, which is Oregon Sheriff's Association, that in Oregon, they're broadly in charge of search and rescue. So you would need for each county a group that has been basically vetted and okayed by your county sheriff's department that they could call on. And that's basically what they do for all the other user groups. So like snowmobiling, equestrians, climbers, et cetera. And so there is a little bit of onboarding that the sheriff does just so that they know that you know all the rules that they're beholden to and all the liability concerns. And there would be some sort of base level knowledge test. So if you are someone that has whitewater classes or rescue classes that you've taught or taken, that is a great time to show those certificates or the proof of hours. But also if you're just an expert paddler that has had that experience on the ground and you can do a demonstration of a skill set that meets their requirement, that would be another way to do it. But the biggest step is formalizing a group and then starting a line of communication with your county sheriff.
When you say demonstrate things, is it, go ahead, Eric. I have a lot of questions.
Isn't this becoming an issue or is now an issue with the Mount Hood rescue teams? Because there's a couple teams on Mount Hood and there's all sorts of funding issues and also who's in charge issues that are happening there that would impact how exactly this could play out elsewhere.
Exactly. And a lot of it really just kind of rolls up into liability. And in Oregon, we don't really have strong recreation immunity or liability protection. So anytime you're recreating anywhere, you could pretty much sue anyone for anything that happens. And so if you're helping with a search and rescue, you end up getting hurt, it puts the sheriffs in a pretty vulnerable position. And that is certainly something like what you're talking about, Eric, that's happening with all these volunteer-led groups that are really useful in search and rescue. But when stuff happens and, you know, fatalities happen, it's a crazy network of trying to mitigate just getting people who are trying to help away from getting horrible liability lawsuits, but also protecting professional search and rescue professionals from taking on additional liability from engaging with volunteers. So that's something that is like a really big picture, hard thing to solve. But there are effective groups that are already protected under the liability umbrella of the sheriff's departments who have gone through brief training with them. And I think they have to do like an annual or maybe quarterly meet with the sheriff's department just to make sure they're all on the same page.
One of my goals personally this year is to just do a lot more training myself. Go out and practice swimming, practice with throwback rescue, practice being on a tether. Just go out and practice these things, practice setting up tire rolling traverse or whatever those things are. Just practice, do it. Not just like talk about like, oh, go practice, throw your throwback, go do it. Yeah. And then I thought that would work really well with this. Like the idea would be to form like a small organization of like five people that we go try to train once every week for an hour on Thursdays or something, just like a weekly thing. And then we become like a loosely affiliated group. Maybe we make ourselves a 501c something.
Yeah.
And then go to the sheriff and say, if you ever need a group of five people to help with some sort of search water rescue thing, call us. We have some expertise. We're there for you. And then continually try to train. I don't really want to start an organization. I don't like, that's not something I'm dying to do, but maybe start it, but then hand it off to somebody else to kind of take on long term. But it makes sense that every boating community, I've been thinking of this a lot. Every boating community has some sort of like small group of five paddlers or so that trains on a regular basis. And maybe they train on Tuesdays and then anybody's invited to join. So maybe 10 people show up 1 week, maybe two the next week. But it provides ongoing training for paddlers and is a resource for the sheriff's department if they that they would call, you know, that they need assistance. Not like that we would be like rescue squirrels and say, you know, here we're on the police radar. We're listening to police radio all the time. And we're like, oh, there's an emergency. We're going to rush out there. We'd be available as a resource.
Yeah. How would this interact with, you know, I think of like the Medford Fire Department has a pretty active swift water rescue team. You know, professional rescuers. It feels to me like those folks would not be excited about a growth of this type of group.
Then you don't. Then you wouldn't do it. You don't need it.
Yeah. So I think it's when you're talking about that, and that's a perfect example, is scenarios where there's a rescue on Powerhouse or Nugget. They're still probably going to be the people that respond. But an incident like where we had where someone was stuck on a tributary of the Chetco, having a skilled group of people that are local paddlers that have rescue skill set is going to be much more valuable in that type of a scenario where you're not going to have a fire department be able to access them. And then that would be where you can call it a call list of folks that the sheriff's department has. They can call upon them for, you know, things as easy as, well, they were paddling this section, so where would they be, to, can you come out with us and help locate this person? So there's a range of tools that could be utilized with a network of experienced and then also just like vetted, trusted individuals in the whitewater community.
But I think in Medford's case, you just don't do this. They have a team.
Well, right? We're mainstream rivers, but it's still in conversations with them, it would still be valuable for remote rugged rescue to have qualified individuals to help in those scenarios sometimes.
Well, and they're more rescue than search. Is that probably accurate?
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, I'm certain that they do some search and rescue, like, you know, locating people on stretches of the Rogue, and they do lots of stuff like that in the summertime. But I think that's a good general summary.
Well, and in Big Search, I mean, all the people you could have, I think probably sometimes is helpful, would be my understanding, like from some of the stuff we've seen in Southern Oregon in the past.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. But yeah, so I've been having conversations with people. I'm talking with a guy on the East Coast about a similar effort that he's engaging with, following the scenario that we talked about briefly on a previous podcast. So he was one of the rescuers in that scenario, and he's talking with search and rescue about the same idea to kind of help in those same remote rugged scenarios where they sometimes are not best equipped to deal with it in a timely fashion. But I think the most important thing is to just kind of like start the conversation, see who in your community is interested, and start a kind of informal conversation with your local sheriff and kind of see where it goes from there.
Yeah. If the sheriff's like, no, we're good, I'm like, cool, you guys got this.
I don't think he will. I think your local sheriff will be like, sweet, Priscilla's already told me about this. If you're one of the people that wants to help, let's talk.
Yeah, I think it depends on the community. I'm pretty sure here in Hood River, there's no, this doesn't exist. Like I don't think they have the expertise. This would probably affect us like if somebody didn't come back from the West Fork of the Hood, for example,
Exactly.
You know, people with knowledge of the watershed on a particular section. Oh, they probably hiked out here, or they might have got stuck here. Let's go paddle down, mm-hmm. you know, and see what's happening. At least the sheriff knows who to call to paddle down,
yep.
you know, versus maybe posting on Facebook, hey, who can paddle down the West Fork and do search and rescue for us? Like, I don't think they would do that, but
no,
they, it's just a resource that they would have. And I think, you know, in that Kanawha Falls incident, as you know, I listened to the Hammer Factor podcast about it afterwards, which is amazing.
Yeah.
Like, crazy. You know, I think that the search and rescue team there, if they had a team of paddlers to call that were trained and familiar with the area, that certainly would have helped.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's kind of our overall outlook is like, if we can be a resource that can help and, you know, ultimately help save more people or keep people from having horrible and long lived periods of time in bad scenarios, like that's great. And that's exactly what our first responders want as well. And they're not going to be people generally that are going to paddle down a segment of stream to go look for someone. It's all going to be land-based, which has its own limitations. So yeah.
Yeah. And as I get older, I'm way more likely to swim. You know, I see this, you know, in 5 years, me paddling one day and swimming and hoping there's a search and rescue team to come and get me.
Well, hope that doesn't happen too much.
I hope not either.
Well, since we're talking about safety, did we want to start talking about our main topic?
Yeah, PFDs. I feel like I've been talking about PFDs all summer long. Everybody has questions and thoughts and wanting to get what you guys think are like the good PFDs right now. And And I think that everybody feels like the green jacket is the standard. Like that's the jacket. What do you think?
Well, I'll let Eric talk first because I'm going to look up something really quick.
I think in river guiding, rightfully or wrongly, and maybe like more active kayaking, like so people who are, you know, would consider themselves like proper kayakers, who that's kind of their sport, I would say that is probably true. The green jacket is sort of the thing that everything else is compared against. There are people who intentionally probably don't use green jacket because that is the reality. And I suspect there's a lot of people who have a green jacket who don't need it. But it sure seems like a standard. I mean, they kind of were some of the first to have some of the floating, you know, body parts and the way it molded around you. And they, like the green jacket, the original one from years, like generations ago, like they really changed the game in a lot of ways. And everybody else kind of followed suit. I don't think they are out there by themselves as far as greatness like they used to be. A lot of other people have sort of caught up or copied or whatever. There's a lot of other good jackets out there now too that are in that same wheelhouse. I think when I think about PFDs, it seemed like for a while there was a ton of progression kind of around the green jacket and everything that Astral was doing. And it was like, oh, what's a cool thing going to be this year? Like, what's the new jacket that's going to come out with cool features that I definitely want? Mm-hmm. And it sort of feels like that progress has waned, like the curve has flattened in progress. Like the things that happen now, like in the last 5 years, I feel like the biggest change has been like maybe a zipper or a pocket has changed slightly.
Yeah.
It's not as fun as it used to be, but
yeah. Yeah. I think so
on the top
too.
End, I think there's some fun stuff in the mid level, but
yeah, I think when you're talking about like type five, like rescue vests, they pretty much all have the same features, just in a different configuration. For example, with the Astral rescue life jacket, the green jacket, something that a lot of folks I've been talking to and myself find kind of annoying is that it doesn't have the side zipper. So if you're wearing a dry suit and a bunch of layers, it can catch on your zippers. And it's like this awkward process of putting it over your head, where like the Kokatat and some of the NRS jackets have a side zip, but also have the same functionality of the other rescue vests, but it's a little bit more convenient to put on with a dry suit. So I think that's something that might just be a personal choice, but a differentiating factor between the different brands. The other thing that I found by testing out a couple different life jackets and talking to other people that don't paddle green jackets, which is what I have right now, is like the width of the strap on your shoulder and if there's buckles or not. So if you're someone that carries your boat around a lot, having a thin strap on the shoulder or one that has like a bunch of buckles and stuff is actually pretty painful to carry your boat, where like the Kokatat, I think it's the Maximus, it has these really wide, like comfortable straps, and it's just like exactly what you would want. It's like a nice piece of padding for the edge of your boat to sit on, and it's super comfortable and it's pretty low profile, so you don't have that bulge in the front when you're like trying to roll and you feel kind of uninhibited if you have a full pocket of stuff.
Yeah, I think that what's happening is there's PFDs for kayakers and PFDs for raft guides.
Mm-hmm.
And there should be, they're different beasts.
Yeah.
And the Astral has become like the standard for both. And I think it's really good for kayaking and personally not so good for raft guiding.
Yeah.
But it looks cool and has a cool pocket, so people choose it for raft guiding.
Why don't you think it's a good raft guiding jacket?
I think because it has a safety harness. I don't think everybody needs a safety harness. I think that that's something that people like to have because it looks cool and they're you know maybe going to save the day. But I feel like it takes away from the flotation, and it's just one more thing. You know, it's just one more like thing on the PFD to take put on and off every time. So I think that you know the Astral makes the blue. I think it's called the blue jacket. That one's the same vest without the safety harness. But it has, so it has a side zip too. So it's much easier to put on and off. It doesn't have the rescue vest. I've used that. I've used both. Like I have the green jacket for kayaking and I use the blue jacket for raft guiding when it's easier stuff because it's just easier to put off and on all the time. But it's flotation. It has the very minimum amount of flotation you can have in a PFD. I think it's 15.5 pounds, which is the absolute minimum. And a lot, like I think guides should probably have more flotation. So if you take that PFD, it's a couple years old, it loses some flotation. You throw some metal stuff in there, like your rescue gear or like a wrench or something. And you're my size, it barely keeps you afloat. And so I'd like to have something in, you know, in the 20 pound range for raft guiding personally.
Yeah, I can think on certain raft guiding trips, I mean, pretty much everything I've done with OTT, I feel like a lighter weight, just no nonsense life jacket would make a lot of sense. Obviously as a raft guide and a kayaker, I'm going to just get one life jacket and it's probably going to be the one that fits and checks all the boxes. But there's obviously raft guiding on class 5 rivers where I think you'd probably want all the functionality that you'd want as a whitewater paddler with the rescue functionality and the pockets. And I find myself using like the cowtail. Well, I guess you could do the same thing with a piece of webbing, which I know other people do, is just like clipping on to like an IK while you're hopping out to scout, or it's just like something you're not thinking of pulling out of your pocket. And like I've done that to just like hang on to a raft when I'm popping out to take a picture. Just like clip it onto the line in an eddy, pop out. Wait,
you're using your like the cowtail onto your safety harness to clip onto a boat, just really quick.
Yeah.
Okay.
And you know, super easy. Like I'm not doing that in the middle of a rapid.
Yeah. Just like
you know, it's just like I don't have to think about it, and I'm not going to miss taking a photo. But I'm also not going to lose my boat.
Yeah. It's a very quick accessory in like easy positions.
Yeah. But I've also seen a lot of people do that with a long piece of webbing that they keep around their waist. But to me, that's just another thing I have to remember. And the less things I have to remember to bring on a trip, the better for me.
Yeah. I mean, I've become
as Eric knows,
I've become a fan of having just a sling in your pocket. Like I've been using a sling, like a loop of webbing with a carabiner on all the time lately, but it's quickly accessible in a pocket. I've been pulling it in and out all the time.
Yeah. And I've seen you do that. Thing. And I've also seen our friend Joseph do that. And, you know, the time they take to do that is no different than me. So I think that's kind of a preference. That's totally a preference thing. It's not necessary.
That's the thing I love about like the Centurion from Kokatat is the pocket. It's like, I think if there's any life jacket that is somewhat unique out there, I think it's that one because of the amount of pocket space. If you add on the little belly pocket,
Like, I've got full, I carry a full wrap kit in that. I've got prussics, slings, you know, all of it if I wanted to carry it. But I carry tons of slings in there, and I also carry tons of snacks. Because I find as a river guide, having snacks in your pocket, even give people is a huge win.
I think guiding, so, having snacks
like
is
that
huge.
And sunscreen, like all that stuff. Well, and kayaking, I'm a big believer. If your day gets long, having some snacks in your pocket is a bonus for sure. For me. I get hangry.
I think on that specific model too, I really like the low profile. Like, it seems like they've divvied out the pocket space kind of like up to down versus just having one giant pocket that ends up kind of inhibiting your movement. And the other thing I like about that jacket, and I, in talking to people who have paddled this jacket kind of forever, is the side protection, like the rib protection. I guess in earlier models, they used to put a piece of really thin, like, I don't know if it was plastic, but a bit more protective material, like maybe what you'd see in a mountain biking, like protective gear. And they took that out. I'm not sure why, but paddlers that I talked to that had paddled the older version said that they really liked that, and they weren't really stoked when they took that out, because I mean, the rib protection is huge, especially if you're doing, you know, harder whitewater or waterfalls or pretty much anything where you can hit the side of your body on anything.
That's the jacket I use when I was supping a lot, specifically because of that. It had great rib protection. And I, you know, supping is swimming. I swam a lot in my supping phase. And so it's the extra large has 18 pounds of flotation. So it's decent flotation for all my swimming. And rib protection for all my falling on rocks. Eric, is that the PFD you use? Is that your go-to PFD? The Centurion?
Yeah, it's right now. I would like to get a lighter jacket for some other things, like going to play boating, or like river surfing, or even like easy day guiding. I probably wouldn't mind a lighter vest. But right now it's my go-to. I've had it for about a year, two. I think this is my second summer with it. And I really,
do you kayak really with it too?
Yeah.
Okay. It just seems, it felt bulky to me. Are you fine? Like, is it bulky to you, or you're just like, it's bulky, I'll deal with it, 'cause I like it more.
If I have the pockets really full, I find it to be a bit bulky in the front. Like, it wants to come up a little bit, and it's got the cinches underneath where you can pull the front down. And I just find that I have to really keep those cranked, especially if I have decent amount of stuff in the pockets.
Yeah.
But
okay,
I do like the feel of protection. Like, if I go up, if I'm upside down, like going through something shallow, I've always felt like this is going to be a lot. This is going to be really helpful in protecting my kidneys and back. And
it looks cool.
Your important organs.
I haven't looked at this one and you look for a while. I'm on the website right now. It looks really cool, actually.
Yeah.
I like that front pocket. I want to go back to something, Eric. I made a comment. I'm still sort of torn on this thing. Should guides have the rescue harness? And I made the comment to try to start a conversation there. I personally could see both sides.
Oh,
but how do you feel?
You and I have talked about this before. I think that the one time in 1,000 that it's helpful, you'll be happy you have it. But
is it 1 in 1,000 or is it 1 in 10,000 or 1 in 100,000?
Yeah, I think it's more the 10,000 or 100,000. Like, it is very, very low odds that it will ever be helpful to you in your guiding career. There is a chance where it could. Like, I can think of two situations I've been in 20 years. Well, three situations I've been in 20 years of like guiding where it was or would have been helpful.
For a person extraction or a gear extraction. So I think that every example people tell me is, oh, I used it to save a raft or a paddle, or would it actually, I mean, I think most of the application people talk about in rafting is to save equipment, not lives.
One was equipment, two were, there was a person in the game. Like, it was person, there was a person involved in one context or another. And in all of those cases, it wasn't to get the person, or even when we were getting the equipment, It was to help make sure I didn't become a victim in this scenario. In the sense that, like, I'm leaning over something sketchy and someone's going to hold this to keep me from, you know, if I slip, going in the drink and becoming a problem.
Yeah,
that's the, I would agree that's with the that. Most real, to me, that's the most realistic scenario that gets used in guiding, is to belay you, like to help you get into a situation where if you slip or fall, someone else is holding on to you and you're not going to become a part of the problem.
Yeah. I've also seen it in like live bait to get gear out of like a recirculating eddy or something like that, where you don't really want to go swim in there, but you want to be able to be attached to something and have people pull you out. I've seen that.
But that's not really guiding.
That's true. Well, yeah, I guess not guiding. I had a memory of like seat cushions floating in an eddy.
Let them go. They're seat cushions. Like, let them go.
They're river trash. But OTC doesn't have that problem anymore. But yeah, I think Eric's point is the most important, is like not falling into the soup when you're trying to do a rescue.
Eric, so as an outfitter and somebody who employs guides, do you feel like your guides should have rescue harnesses then?
I think what's in our language, and I have to go back and see exactly what I put into our training stuff, but to me, I think I said, if you're going to have this, you should take training and know exactly how to use it. And if you're not going to invest in that training, or you haven't, then you probably shouldn't have it. And definitely, I think we say something along the lines like, we don't require this. And we don't really want you to have it unless you know how to use it.
I'll tell you one thing I've been thinking about a lot lately with these. The last time I was around one being used was with Priscilla on Indigo Creek. And Joseph was setting safety below that like 6-foot drop above the riverwide log of death into a boxed out canyon. And he's like, oh, clip onto me. I may have to jump out and save somebody above the death log. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, cool. But what went through my head was that it didn't seem like I was like, I'll hold on to the rope, but this seems crazy to me. But what made me realize is if he had jumped out, did he 100% know that his buckle was going to hold the force? Has he trained on it? Has he used it with his weight and his abilities in swift water to know if he had to release or that it wouldn't release on its own? Because if he jumped out to save somebody and released on its own, they'd both go into the log, right? Or if he jumped out and had to release, is it set so that it does release? So my fear with these is if people don't practice with them often, they will either release when you don't want them to, or they won't release when you want them to, because the release on them isn't 100%. It depends on your weight and how you've lash the line through the buckle.
Yeah.
And I guarantee that the time, like when you need to use in a hurry at lunch that day, you didn't lash it up perfectly necessarily. And you maybe didn't train in the previous year or two on what that exact lashing is. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think I've talked about this before, but I think with any sort of tool, not just in whitewater, but any sort of rescue tool or tool that you use for recreation, you should practice it and know how to use it so that the time that you need to use it, it isn't like a surprise. I mean, the same thing can be said about throw bags. If you're not packing them correctly, you're not going to be able to help someone. You could cause an entrapment hazard. Like, you should be training to use the tool that you're expected to use.
We all say this stuff, but who actually goes out and does the training? Who actually goes out, puts themselves on live bait and practices?
Well, I mean, I guess I had the privilege and opportunity to do classes that like Eric and I did with Noah's Rafting. We did a bit of that. Did we do that for OSU? I mean, obviously that's a college scenario, so our classes are going to be a lot more comprehensive. I think some guides and outfitters practice that, like on the Tuolumne, like the Cherry Creek section. Some of my friends that guide out there say that they've done that for practice in their annual training. Some people do it on Gore. So I think it's situational, and there are some people that personally practice it for fun with groups of friends in paddling groups, just for like get out and paddle Thursdays or whatever it is in your community. So I think it varies. And if you're an outfitter and you want them to wear those tools or use those tools, you're probably incorporating it into your training on an annual basis or more frequently.
I've never practiced it outside of a swiftwater rescue class.
Really?
No. Is this a thing? Do people do this? I want to
like
do
live
it.
Bait, if anybody like wants live bait practice,
I've never done it outside of a class.
Oh, Eric, outside of a class.
Exactly. I've never like no, I've taken a no two.
Well, me and my brothers have done it for fun, but that was more like wrestling.
Yeah, and I think that nobody. I don't think people practice it. I don't think people. And I have friends who get on Cherry Creek who don't even use rescue vests because they're. You want to go get the person in the raft. You don't. You don't have time. It just doesn't lend itself to being on a rope. So they don't even run the rescue vests guiding up there. Some companies may. I don't know. But my point is, I think that people don't actually practice with these. Although everybody says that they will or they do, I don't think really that they do. And then I see there's a little hazard again because if you use it, it may not release when you need it to because you haven't practiced.
Yeah.
Or it may release unexpectedly when you don't want it to, which is a pretty big scare. Or when you buy a new PFD, the tension setting is important. The length of the tail and how you wrap it through the hardware to make sure for your particular weight and size, I think is really important. So to know that it's 100% going to catch, 100% going to release requires you to retrain every time you get a new PFD and almost recalibrate that PFD to yourself. What do you guys think about that?
I don't wholly understand that part, but I do think that this is a place where the ski industry or snow sports industry has done a much better job of beating in the importance of training with your gear around like avalanche beacons.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Where like that is people who do that. There are still a lot of people who talk about how it's important, but they never do it, like going out to a beacon park and practicing and stuff. But there's at least a broad consensus. Like there's nobody in that sport that would tell you it's not good to practice with your beacon. And probably 50% of people would get out and do at least once a year, go to a practice park or go out and actually train with the gear. Mm-hmm. In the whitewater side of things, I think there's a lot of people who would probably honestly tell you they don't think that practicing with a throw bag or practicing live baiting is important. And I think there's probably like 5% of people who practice it annually at most.
Oh, I think everybody says practicing is important. I just don't think anybody actually follows through with the practice. Nobody's going to say,
but I think my experience would be nobody's going to like, so there's a difference between saying it and believing it, right? I think in the snow sports side, everybody there from my experience, like that industry wide, and it's been led from the companies that make the gear. Like everybody would wholly honestly tell you that it's really good and that they should do it more. Mm-hmm. My experience on the whitewater side is that at the companies who make gear as industry leaders ourselves, we haven't done there is not a standard in our industry where once a year you should go out and spend an hour practicing with your throw bag. Like that is not a thing that is broad across all aspects of the industry. There's probably a huge swath of the non-commercial boating community who probably has never even opened up and thrown their throw bag.
Yeah.
Like in backcountry skiing, that is not a reality. There's probably almost nobody in the backcountry who hasn't at least like tried to use figured out how to use their beacon. Like it's a very small part of the population. Very small.
It's a much different culture. And I think it comes a lot from from the manufacturers. Cause I mean, I see all the time just scrolling through Facebook post about backcountry, like Avi safety, like, oh, have you went out and practiced blah, blah, blah. And I don't, like Eric saying, I don't really see any of that for whitewater. It's like, bring your throwback, but there's not really messaging from manufacturers about practicing with it. And I also think go ahead.
I think I'm going to throw something out there to start a conversation about something I've been thinking about a lot. I think that the difference, this is what I do, just in case you guys were wondering. Sorry to interrupt, Priscilla, but I'm on a path. there's a difference because when you're a backcountry skier, you know about avalanches and people who've died in avalanches. It's a regular thing. it's a real fear. When you're out there, you're like, man, this could slide. I'm glad I'm on top of the game with the right people. When you're paddling, there's not stories that are like, oh man, if I only had a throwback, could have saved his life. Right? Like there's not stories like, oh man, that person died. And if we'd only had our rescue harness, we could have saved our life. Like it's not, we're not getting those reminders.
Yeah. Where
like it's more likely to die in an avalanche because you don't have your beacon than it is to die on a river because you don't have your throw bag or your rescue harness.
Well, I think there's truth to that. I think another latent component is that there are a lot of things that people get away with in whitewater, and there's a lot of getting lucky and like,
it's a surprisingly really, forgiving sport.
Exactly. And so because of that, I think that maybe there's an immediate like, oh crap, like I'm going to remember to bring my throw bag because my buddy got really lucky right there. Mm-hmm. But when you're talking about backcountry alpinism or backcountry skiing, like you're not really getting lucky a lot. Like mm-hmm. if something goes bad,
yeah,
I think it goes pretty bad. And that's me saying it without a lot of experience. So Eric will probably have more thoughts on it, but I think there's like a short-term memory aspect of people getting away with a lot of things they really shouldn't be in whitewater, and in other sports, it just doesn't happen as often.
I also think there's a lower level of technical skill set to throw. Like yeah. throwing a throw bag is a pretty low level of technical skill versus mm-hmm. understanding this pocket computer that of an avalanche beacon that you have and how it works. Like this thing's more complicated than say Shuttle Went to the Moon was. Yeah. And there's a learned skill set there that's different than throw bag. Like there's people who are good throw bags, people who are bad. And I can tell you as someone who, when you're swimming into a cave and watch someone throw the throw bag into a tree above them and not to you, it's a pretty sad moment where you wish they practiced more.
But has that happened to you?
Yes.
Okay. That sucks. Well, it was
a sad moment.
You're swimming into a cave and you watch the throw bag go straight up in the air.
Yeah,
you
I
had the.
Swimming,
you were looking for the bag coming to you.
Water trip on the Little White.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it was sacrilege on the Little White, and I swam into the cave on the left of the drop, like in the undercut there. And as I was swimming into it, I watched them across the river throw a bag into the tree above them. As they were trying to get to me, it was sad moment on the inside.
Good example of how forgiving whitewater is.
So we're good. We're all good.
I think that's the point, though, is that's how forgiving whitewater is. You swam into a cave, the rescue didn't happen, and it turned out good. If there was that level of confidence.
But it, yeah, it was.
But I want to get back to the point I'm trying to get at is I feel like if people are going to wear these rescue vests, there needs to be a regular training with them and not just I buy one and I'm a rescue squirrel. Right. And yeah. I think that this goes a little bit in line with my new idea to have like weekly trainings here in the gorge, you know, or like having, I think it'd be cool to have like every watershed or whatever community has like a rescue team that works with the sheriff's department and then provides weekly or monthly trainings for the community to come out and practice with the throw bags, practice with their rescue vests, you know, on a regular basis. I don't know if I want to take that on because I have a dog and stuff. I got to walk my dog a lot, but maybe I should, maybe I will, but it'd be nice to have that. And so that we're regularly out training with these things if we're going to have this equipment.
So Zach, is this where you offer your weekly classes that you're offering?
Or, no. No.
Zach's not paid for his classes.
No, well, it's not. If I did, look, I don't want to.
No,
I want to practice more, but to practice, you need friends. Like, you can't practice using a rescue harness by yourself. You have to go out with like 2, 3, 4, or 5 people to practice that skill. So you need to convince people to go with you and stand in the cold and jump in the river just to practice. Where most people, like, no, I'm going to go paddle instead. Then, like, let's go to the river and practice with our rescue harnesses.
Yeah, I think that.
Whereas if it was a regular weekly.
The closest thing in my mind to this that you're talking about is role sessions, like pool mm-hmm. role sessions that people go to. Like, mm-hmm. that's sort of the comparison opportunity here in the whitewater world and would be sort of the natural outlet for something like this to be an add on. You know, if you go to a pool session or a role session, is there a throw bag, like tossing contest on the side, you know, in the evening when people are there? It's not really great for live practice, but.
So, yeah, I mean, the past couple of weeks we've been doing this filming for this project. And so as part of it, we've been doing throw bag filming of throw bag tossing. And we've been doing, at the end of the day, when we're like out shooting film, we'll each do two or three of the IRF throw bag standard tests, which is a throw and a rethrow within 25 seconds. And so that requires three of us, one person throwing for and two people in the water. And so we'll each take turns being in the water versus throwing. It's been kind of fun, but to get motivated to just go up there and do it is hard. You know, we're already up there on the side of the river with the, you know, all the stuff, but I'm realizing the value of going out and practicing with throw bags on a regular basis. It would be fun to find some people to go out and do the rescue harness thing. And almost like, you know, having a week, maybe it's a monthly session and not paid, just like, hey, let's go out and practice, like volunteer, just anybody else will show up in the community. Cool. Let's practice. Right. If you have a rescue harness, you should go out and use it in training, an opportunity for regular training to happen in a boating community. I'm just brainstorming here, trying to figure this out. Because I worry about people having rescue harnesses and having them release, like I said, release when they don't expect them to, or not release when they want them to.
Yeah.
This is just me like trying to brainstorm how to properly use this stuff. And we're off the topic of throw bags, or off the topic of PFDs by far. So back to PFDs.
I got one for a PFD competition. What PFD question? Mm-hmm. So I see this a lot, and I've had real mixed feelings on it. Astral makes a throw bag that can go into your life jacket, like in the front, mm-hmm. right? Or they mm-hmm. did, like a little mm-hmm. front pocket kind of thing. I feel like I see a lot of photos of guides who have taken the waist belt throw bags, you know, like RS mm-hmm. makes one and all those, and they strap them to like the back of their life jacket. Like kind of below mm-hmm. behind their shoulders, you know what I'm talking about? And so it's kind like of. Built onto their life jacket.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't get it. I feel like it's this thing I see a lot of lately.
You don't get why they're carrying a throw bag with them.
I sort of question having it strapped on that way. Like the ones that tuck in the front, I get that. Like it's tucked mm-hmm. in, it's inside, it's easy to access. Like, I understand that. I kind of understand wearing the waist belt ones on your waist.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I don't get strapping the waist belt ones to your life jacket.
I've never seen that. It sounds like a terrible idea. So just That's to go it. Back, I think the ones that you put on your chest, that you put like strap in the front of your PFD, the issues I have with those is they're too short. They're usually only like 30 feet long, and that's almost useless.
Yeah.
And it's harder to Agreed. Get back, put yourself in the raft with all that bulk in front of you. So I think that as a guide or a rafter, they're not very good. As a kayaker, maybe that's great. Then the waist belt throw bag, honestly, is pretty sweet. I think it's just like, especially as a guide, you always have it available. I'm a fan. Anything you do to modify your PFD is dangerous. So if you're somehow attaching your throw bag to your PFD in some way that's unexpected, it changes the flotation of the vest. And I think it's a bad idea. I think permanently attaching your throw bag to your vest is not good. Because it might float you, like they're designed to float a particular way, right? If you change where the mass is on them, especially with something that big, it could change. So I definitely wouldn't do that. I'm guessing
you're How many knives do you carry on your life jacket?
I mean, knives?
I think so, yeah. Well, I sort of think, well, I got to thinking, like, the bulk of that isn't that much more than, say, like, five carabiners. Like, as far as total mass, everybody shoves five carabiners in their pocket, without thinking twice about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think twice about it.
You're like the one.
Yeah.
Come on, there's tons of people that don't shove five carabiners in their pocket.
I've definitely carried the Astral little mini throw bag, mm-hmm. and I haven't found it to be an issue. The only issue I found it to be is when I'm kayaking, whether it's on my back or my front, it ends up kind of messing with rolling, and other than that, I haven't really noticed anything. I found it's pretty nice to have that waist strap throw bag for like rafting, just because it's super convenient.
Yeah. I mean, Eric, I don't know for sure the attaching the throw bag to the back of your PFD is dangerous or not. I would just be hesitant to make any modification to a PFD. Right. And it sounds like if you just sew something to your PFD, that's bad. So that's my thinking. I mean, the weight, I don't know, but I think that I've never seen that. So that my first reaction is I wouldn't do that. Back to more PFD stuff. I think my theory here right now is that we need to think of PFDs in two ways. One, kayaker PFDs, you know, and I think rafters and river guides need a different PFD. And I think that PFD should have nice pockets for putting like a little bit of safety gear in. It should be give a little bit more protection and have a little more flotation. And there should be an optional safety harness to add on to it if people want that.
Certainly the flotation piece I would agree with. Optional safety harness would be great. But yeah, I think ample pockets, easy to get on and off. Like, so not a pullover, but you know, either a side zip or something like that. And lots of flotation. Like definitely when I'm out guiding on the salmon at, you know, 70,000.
Yeah.
Flotation is definitely appealing. Yep. Like lots and lots of it. So
I think some people want that flotation. Or if you're a big person, you just want a lot of flotation. Yeah. You know, it's a nice bonus. So, and then going back to something you sort of said at the start, I just lost my train of thought. Sorry. I had something in my brain, but I forgot what it was. Damn it.
Bummer.
But, Priscilla left. Should we wrap this thing up, Eric?
Yeah. Are we still doing gear of the week? Like I said, I've been gone a long time. So
yeah, we're still doing gear of the week, although it's been kind of tough because we're kind of geared out. So it's more like thing of the week, just something that we like or that we've used of the week.
Yeah.
I'll start because I have one of mine that's related to PFDs. I've been using the Palm Nevis PFD lately, and you can't get it in the US. A friend of mine shipped it to me over here, but I think it's pretty cool. And I think the coolest thing about it is that they put a lot of pockets on it. There's a lot of pocket options, and they even thought about where the phone would go.
What PFD is this?
It's called the Palm Nevis, and
Palm
is a Palm, P-A-L-M. It's a European company. It's Nevis,
E-N-E-V-I-S. Yeah, gotcha. Totally, yeah.
And it's a new PFD that came out with. It has a little bit more flotation. It has a lot of these things we talked about. And it has really nice pockets built into the front for like pulling out safety gear. And so since I've been wearing this PFD more, I've been pulling out my little flip line out of it a lot more. Whereas the Astral is on the side of my like little side pouch. I have to do yoga to get it out. Having it super available, I've been pulling that little line out to do all kinds of things because it's more convenient. So it's not perfect. It's not the perfect PFD. It's pretty cool. Yeah, I'm excited about it. And I got it like a month or two, probably 2 months ago. It was a little bulky for me kayaking. I don't love kayaking with it, but for raft guiding, it's got tons of pockets, and it's, you know, I like it because it's a bright color. One thing we didn't talk about is color. I got a bright orange one, so I'm more visible.
Yeah,
but
no, that's a good looking vest. I've watched them for a while. I've always thought they had kind of creative stuff. I always thought that they used what looked like cheaper, like flat webbing and some other components in the past. When I looked at their stuff, felt a little cheap. But this looks super robust. I like this. It's a good looking jacket.
So we're checking out and maybe sending them a note saying, hey, let's get this stuff to the US. You know, it'd be cool to like, if you like it, send them a note and say, hey, you guys have some cool things. They have great throw bags too. And a lot of other stuff. It'd be nice to get some of that stuff here in the US.
Yeah. You could get some of it in the US for a while. I thought.
I think it's hard right now. I
saw catalogs from them or something a couple of years ago. I remember looking at buying some stuff. Is it?
Yeah. Okay. This one actually isn't, it's not rated for the Coast Guard. So it's technically like it's not rated by the Coast Guard, which is an issue too.
Yeah, totally.
It's rated by the European Coast Guard, whatever that is.
Yeah. So my thing of the week is this summer I picked up an old Honda Trail 90, like, you know, motorcycle.
Oh,
like a,
man.
Like a 67. And
cool.
I got a hitch rack for my truck. So like a motorcycle rack. And then I welded another hitch receiver onto that rack. So I can put the motorcycle rack in my truck, put the motorcycle on it, and then attach my raft trailer or my drift boat to the motorcycle rack. So I can, it's a one system shuttle. Like I can go shuttle myself fully with my old Honda motorcycle. And the funny thing is that now since I got it, I've seen like four other people doing this. I've shown up, there's Honda Trails at like Honda Trail 90s at the, or 110s at, you know, the put in or take out. So I'm not the only person out there doing this, but like I went, took my drift boat out the last two weekends and it's rad. I can just go run myself shuttle. It's super smooth and easy, totally COVID friendly. It's rad. Love it.
Did you say it's like a 1967?
I think mine's a 67.
Yeah. So Honda, I'm following this right now because I really wanted to get a motorcycle and my wife thinks I'll die, which is a valid concern. And we have a 49cc Honda, like little Metro thing I run around town. But Honda has a new, they have a new Trail 125. You know, there's a new Honda Trail 125.
Yeah, basically they've remade it. They're relaunching the whole, they're relaunching the whole series. It's awesome.
I think I've talked my wife into letting me get one. So like I might get the new version. Although getting a used one's probably a better idea.
The price on them, honestly, the used ones are expensive. Like, I mean, I found a deal on this one. That's why I did it.
Yeah.
But I could probably turn around and sell it for 50% more than I bought it because there's people out there that are really passionate about them. So they kind of have an inflated market, but you can find decent ones for $1,500 pretty easily. But the new ones are going to be like $3,000, I think. And they'll be fuel injected and have some real benefits to them.
Yeah, I mean, so I think the solo shuttle is a thing. COVID is not going away. The idea of the solo shuttle is just going to grow this next year.
Yeah, it's pretty rad. Like that's why I bought it. I had sort of had this dream of how do I set up a motorcycle to do a self shuttle. I've been thinking about it a long time. It's nice because it's super light. Like this setup wouldn't work if you got a heavier bike because you'd put too much weight on the motorcycle rack, and then by the time you add your boat, you'd have way too much tongue weight to where it'd get like really sketchy. But this bike weighs so little. I mean, it probably weighs less than 100 pounds or right around 100 pounds.
Yeah.
Like it's super easy. The whole system's really light and I'm loving it. So right on. Well, for those of you listening to the pod, doing whatever it is one does these days, hopefully it's something fun, finding water somewhere and going boating. And I think boating season proper should start here soon. And we'll try and broadcast it
right here in the gorge.
Good. Exciting. Well, all right. Until next pod. Cool. Gonna float me into a new state of mind.